As Richard said, by way of introduction, we've come tonight to the second of a four-part series looking at the book of Nehemiah, and it would be a great help if you'd turn to it. It's on page 420 of the Old Testament section of the Bibles in the pews. And as you find it, let me pose you a question. Imagine that you were going to be away from, say, your boyfriend or girlfriend or maybe husband or wife for a long period of time. You were going to be going somewhere where British Telecom couldn't reach you with a call and where the GPO couldn't reach you with a letter. You know, somewhere like Scunthorpe or somewhere like that. Imagine you were going away. What would you give to your girlfriend or boyfriend? What would you leave with them so that they would know you're coming back and to help them to stick by you in your absence? A letter, perhaps? A photograph, perhaps? A locket of your hair, perhaps, for those of you lucky enough still to have enough hair to give away lockets. What would you leave with them? Some while ago, my mother went on a visitation of our rabbits and relations, and she left my dad on his own for a few days. Well, Mother's preparations were meticulous. Meals in the freezer with instructions on how to heat them up, easy cooked meals in the fridge, only needing a short visit to the microwave to be edible, cold meats and salads enough to feed an army for a month, enough food to feed a large army for months and months. And my dad was only going to be on his own for two nights. But he was equipped to survive. In fact, all he needed was his checkbook and a phone number of the local home delivery pizza man, in fact, but nonetheless. Now, the book of Nehemiah comes at the end of the Old Testament history. And at the end of it, there's going to be a 400 or so year wait for Jesus to come. And as we study through the book of Nehemiah, we're expecting to discover the provision God makes for his people. The provision God makes so that his people will be thoroughly equipped to wait for Jesus to come, be prepared for him, and be waiting faithfully for him. So that the people of God can survive. Now, last week we saw that in the first two chapters of the book of Nehemiah, that the first of these provisions was the restoring of the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem had been destroyed 150 years or so earlier, and the Old Testament tells us that it was a judgment by God for the people's rebellion against him. And so the city was destroyed, the temple was flattened, the walls were demolished. Although a new temple had been built by the time of Nehemiah, the city itself was still in tatters. And so in Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 1, we discover the man Nehemiah, a Jew, living in exile in Persia. He hears up-to-date news of Jerusalem, his ancestral city. He hears that the walls are smashed and that the people are shamed. And last week we asked the question, how did the city get restored? Or how did that work get started? And we saw that it was through the man Nehemiah, a man motivated, a man who prayed, and a man who took opportunities. And that was through to chapter 2 and verse 10. We saw it was through Nehemiah, but we also saw that it was through God's hand. Have a look at chapter 2 and verse 8 for a moment. There we see that it was unmistakably God who provided the building to start. It was God's work, it was Nehemiah's work. Well, tonight we're going to look mainly at chapter 4, and instead of posing the question, how did this rebuilding work get started, I want us to answer the question, how did the rebuilding work get finished? How did the rebuilding work get finished? Now, in chapter 2 and verse 11, excuse the flipping about, you'll have to do that, so it keeps you warm in a cold building to keep your hands flipping through the pages. In chapter 2, verse 11, we see that Nehemiah legs it, well, it probably camels it, to Jerusalem. It's a long way. He gets there and he susses out for 3 days the situation of the city. And then he calls all the leaders together and describes for them what God has done up until then. And the people respond in chapter 2 and verse 18. And they say together, well, let's go for it. Or as the RSV puts it, let's rise up and build. And then from chapters 3 to 6, we get the story of the rebuilding of the city wall itself. And it's fascinating what we're told in chapters 3 to 6. There are no architectural drawings. There's no quantity surveyors' lists of materials, and there's no accountants' financial forecasts. Chapter 3, well, perhaps cast your eye over it for just a moment. Chapter 3 gives us a list of unpronounceable and incomprehensible names. And it tells us the work that each of these names did. Now, lists of names are usually important in the Bible, and they're recorded here for us because they show us that everyone was involved in the rebuilding. It's not just a story of Nehemiah here. It's a story of all the people who were involved in the building, and everyone was. Whether you were clergy or whether you were laity, whether you were a man or whether you were a woman, you were involved in this rebuilding work. And we think that every member ministry is a new idea today. Now, it's right here in chapter 3 of Nehemiah. But then chapters 4 to 6 deal with the hindrances to the rebuilding. Chapters 4, 5 and 6, three quarters of the space given to the rebuilding of the city wall, deal with hindrances that come against it. The difficulties that the people of God have in doing God's work. And so as we answer the question, how did the work get finished? From chapters 4 to 6, we have to say that it was with difficulty. A reminder to us, surely, that God's work is hard and inevitably opposed. God's people always and have always faced difficulty, have always faced hardship, and usually have always faced opposition in their service to him. And so as we begin today a decade of evangelism, it's surely going to bring for us hard work if we're going to be faithfully involved in it. It will surely bring opposition to us if we're going to be involved in it. So the Christian Union in the college or the hospital, the lone witness in the office, the only Christian in a family of non-Christians, the church working in the city, ought to expect real hard work and real opposition. Three chapters here of the story of the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem are given to the hindrances or the opposition to that rebuilding work. To show us that the inevitability of the hindrances to God's work. And if you read through them, you'll discover that chapters 4 shows the hindrances to the work that come from outside the people of God. Chapter 5 shows the hindrances that come from within the people of God. And chapter 6 shows the opposition that comes to the leader of the people of God. So chapters 4 to 6 show us the opposition that comes to God's work. They show us the types of opposition that can come to work to God's work. And chapters 4 to 6 nonetheless encourage us to see how these hindrances can be overcome and the walls still get completed. Well, as we said tonight, we're going to concentrate on chapter 4 and so turn to it. It's on page 423. The opposition that comes to God's work from outside his people. The opponents mentioned in verses 1 to 3 have already made a couple of appearances in the book of Nehemiah in chapter 2. Early indications of opposition to come. They're called Sanballat or Sanblast and Tobiah or Toby for short. They live in the area round about Jerusalem. These guys have always been used to a weak Jerusalem ever since they grew up as children. They saw Jerusalem as a weak city. It's not in their interests to have Jerusalem as a strong city. They may have felt threatened by having a strong city, a restored Jerusalem. Or maybe it was just they rather enjoyed the sort of superior position of being able to look down on a tattered Jerusalem and a tattered people of God. Whatever their motive and cause of the anger and rage in verse 1, they show us through the chapter at least two forms of attack that come from outside. The first is mockery. Sanballat, who's the ringleader, begins to mock in verse 1, and in verse 2 we have the substance of the mockery. His mockery is done in public just to enhance the ridicule, but he first mocks the people, these miserable Jews. These feeble Jews, mocked because they're God's people. Now, I suspect most of us have had something like that at some time or other. Terry was telling us something of the fear of mockery that he himself had experienced. The sort of mockery, you know, Peter's a Christian. And it's not meant as a compliment. Oh, you know, Joanna, she's a holy Joanna. Being mocked because we're known as Christians. But notice, second, that the mocking is against the religious practice as well. In verse 2, will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Or as the Good News Bible puts it, do they think that by offering sacrifices they can finish in a day? Sanballat is sneering at the practice of offering sacrifices. Sacrifices which were part of the Jewish worship or their religious practice. Mockery that comes at the way things are done. Mockery that comes at what we do as God's people. This morning my next door neighbours came to church here. And right the way through the service, as I was sitting next to them, I kept wondering what on earth they thought of what was going on. Not that I was embarrassed by anything that went on at St Helens here this morning, but all the time I wondered what they were thinking of it. And wondering whether they were going to give me a hard time afterwards for what went on here this morning. In fact, they didn't. They got a parking ticket instead for where they parked their car, which was some relief for me. But most of us will have heard some mocking because of what we do as Christians. Because of the fact we come to church here at St Helens. Because we go to a Read, Mark, Learn group. Because of our religious activity. But then third, notice the mocking is directed at God's work itself. So in verse 3, Sanballat enlists the help of his crony friend Tobiah. What, are they going to rebuild the wall? Well, even a fox would be able to knock it down. Not just a mocking for being God's people, not just a mocking for their religious practice, but a mocking at the very work they're doing for God. This is mocking at every area of who these people are and what they're doing. This kind of mocking can become a hindrance or opposition to the work of God. Because it has power. Now, most of us don't like being mocked. We're an odd sort of person if we like being mocked. Most of us don't like being ridiculed, and most of us don't like it especially if it's in front of other people. Therefore, it's very easy for us to remain silent about the fact that we're Christians. Very easy for us to remain silent about the fact that we go to church. Very easy for us to remain silent that we help with the Sunday school or that we help with the coffee in church. Very easy because of the fear of mock. And so we play down our commitment. We play down what we do. We play down that we're Christian because we don't want people to mock us. And mockery can paralyze us into inactivity if we allow it. And most of us, from time to time, if we're honest, will have to say, yes, that has happened to us. I wonder whether you ever remember as a child hearing some saying like this, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. It's poppycock. It's not true. And don't tell any of your children that. Words do hurt, and the fear of them hurting us can paralyze us from saying anything. Mockery, the first weapon here used by the opponents of chapter 4. The second attack is that of threats. In verses 7 and 8. In verses 7 and 8, Sanballat and Tobiah discover that their mocking hasn't worked, that it hasn't stopped the restoring of the walls. And in fact, the construction work is going rather well. And so they get their heads together and they plan to come and attack Jerusalem, to stir up trouble in the city. Now, this attack, or planned attack, doesn't ever happen. But there is a very real threat of it. A real threat that's hanging in the air over Jerusalem. So notice in verse 10 that it seems that some of those working on the wall had begun to become demoralized by it. The threats of verses 11 and 12 seem to have been repeated often. The Jews who were living around about kept on coming and repeating the threats of attack that they'd heard. They thought that attack might come at any moment. I read recently in one of the Sunday papers that after Kuwait was attacked in August by Iraq, that virtually no industrial work has been taking place in the neighbouring country of Saudi Arabia. The threat of attack and the preparations from defence has rendered the Saudi Arabian construction industry virtually redundant. No work happening there at all. It's come to a standstill. The threats here were of real opposition to the work of restoration. And it's easy to see how the threat of attack can stop the work. And I just wonder today whether it's becoming increasingly common for Christians doing God's work to come under threats. Certainly in some countries that's true. A good friend of mine, up until recently, worked for 7 years in Turkey. It became known that he was a Christian. And he had constant threats of attack if he did any evangelism in Turkey, which is illegal. Or last year I visited Romania, and many of the pastors said that there was a constant threat that they used to live under if they did any evangelism in that country. Or in our country, it wouldn't surprise me if there are people here tonight who have come under the threat of attack just because they're Christian. Up until this last summer, and I hope to carry on, I've been playing in a cricket team where everyone else is a non-Christian. I remember very well the second time I played for this team. Our opening bowler, he's about 6'14", the sort of chap that makes John Samuel look small, and he weighed about 18 stone, the sort of chap that makes me look thin, and he charged into the changing room one day. "I can't stand Christians," he said. "I could kill that vicar of our parish." Well, I didn't want to let on just at that moment what my own particular profession was. Didn't think that it was wise for my own health. Yeah, we do live sometimes with threats of attacks. Mockery and threats, two weapons here used by Sanballat and Tobiah in their attempts to oppose the restoring of the city. But back to our original question. If God provided the restored city, how did this work get finished? Well, the first answer is through the man Nehemiah again. And we see in him in this chapter a brilliant mixture of both spiritual and practical responses to opposition, so mixed that they're really rather hard to tell apart. We'll notice the more spiritual ones first, because that's in fact what the text does for us. Notice in both 4, in response to the mocking, and in verse 9, in response to the threat of attacks, the response is the same, and it's prayer. We prayed to our God. Now, at first reading, the prayer in verse 4 doesn't seem a particularly spiritual prayer. Just cast your eye over it. "Zot out the enemies, Lord, please." But the motivation behind the prayer and the content of the prayer is that God wouldn't allow the evildoer to stop his work. That God's work wouldn't be hindered by the evil person and that God would deal with them. Now we hear a lot today, don't we, about first responses and first strikes. It's in the news a lot at the moment. Well, here's a first response, a first strike to both types of attack. Prayer. A crying to God that he would continue the work. A showing of thorough dependence on him. But it's not just the enemy that needs dealing with in this chapter, because as we saw in verse 10, the opposition had begun to have an effect on the builders as well. They heard these repeated threats of attack, and it began to demoralise them. They said, "We can't do the work anymore." And so in verse 14, we see that Nehemiah preaches a sermon. Nehemiah exhorts the people to remember the God they're serving, to refocus their attention so their gaze isn't just on the opponents, but it's redirected to the God they're working for. To keep their perspective on God's greatness and God's awe, a better translation for terrible. Remember the Lord is Nehemiah's exhortation. And that's not just a pious pep talk from Nehemiah. Because if the people didn't believe this, they would very easily give up on this reconstruction work. Very easily stop work. They needed to be reminded that God was great. God is great. Whatever opponents can throw up at them. Prayer and preaching or exhortation. But there are practical responses in the chapter too. Cast your eye from verse 9. Verse 9, we prayed and we set a guard. Lovely balance between the practical and the spiritual. We prayed and we also set a guard. In verse 16, we're told that half of the people worked on the wall while the other half acted as defence. In verse 17, we're told that they worked while carrying weapons as well. In verse 22, we see that Nehemiah made the people stay in the city together at night. There was no hopping on the 532 from Jerusalem Junction home to the leafy suburbs. No, it was all hands on deck. And perhaps with lovely humour at verse 23, the best defence of all. No one changed their clothes. No wonder the attack didn't come from the enemy roundabout. No, that's not what it says. No, it shows a seriousness of what they were doing. They were constantly on guard. How did the wall get finished? At one level, we have to say that it was through the people led by Nehemiah. They responded to the mockery with spiritual fervour, with practical defence, and with hard work. The wall got finished because they kept building. They didn't let these attacks of mockery and threats stop them. Instead, they kept at it. And the text here underlines that. So look at verse 6. So we built the wall. We went on building. We were mocked, but it didn't stop us. We didn't let it prevent us from carrying on building the wall. Or again in verse 15. So we went back to building the wall. Building the wall was not easy. It required hard work through constant opposition. God's people didn't get an easy time of it. That's the constant pattern of the Bible, isn't it? Hard work it will be. Constant opposition there will be. But we keep going as Christian people, serving God. Continue working. How did the wall get built? How did God provide for his people a restored city? Through the efforts, both spiritual and practical, of his people, led by Nehemiah. God does his work through his people, men and women, lay and ordained. But as we saw last week, we can't just say that the work got finished through the efforts of men, that the wall got provided through the efforts of men. The text won't allow us to do that. Will you look at verse 15? God had frustrated their plan. Now, we're not exactly told how that happened in this chapter, but the point nonetheless is still clear. God sovereignly overrules the circumstances, the situation, so that the people, through their activity, sure, achieve God's purpose. And again, that pattern is seen right through the finishing of the restoration of the wall. From chapter 1 to chapter 6, it is clearly God's provision because it is God who works. It is God who builds this city wall. Without God, there would have been no city wall. It was God's plan to provide, and therefore it happened. Sanballat and Tobiah could muster whatever opposition they like. But nonetheless, it was God who provided the wall. God wanted it, and therefore it happened. You cannot. They couldn't hear. They couldn't frustrate the plan of God. Your antagonistic friends can't do it. And let's be grateful for that. Let's be grateful that God's will can't be frustrated. You see, if you could do it, if I could do it, if my non-Christian friends could do it, if the fiercest opponent to Christianity could do it, we'd be in a complete mess. It would make that person bigger than God, greater than God. But the text tells us here that God is great. No, be encouraged. God is in total control. However tough the situation is, God will achieve what he wants. He wanted a restored city. A restored city was what was achieved. We're only 6 weeks away here at St. Helens from our mission, Mind the Gap. It's going to involve us in hard work. It is going to involve us in battling against opposition. But be encouraged. God will achieve what he wants to achieve. God will do his work. He will. God is in the business of being able to overcome whatever opposition man throws at him and still achieve his purposes. And I guess the cross is the very best example that we have of that. God providing the wall. And it's not just here in chapter 4 that we see it. Turn over, if you will, to chapter 6, and we see the same thing again in verse 15. The wall gets finished in 52 days. It's architected, surveyed, and constructed in under 2 months. But in verse 16, we see even the enemies perceived that the work had been completed with the help of our God. Everyone knew that the wall had been completed because God's sovereign hand was upon the situation. From Nehemiah's audience in Persia with King Artaxerxes in chapter 2 to the very last brick placed on the wall, God was providing. In this first provision, you can't get away from the tension in the text here that it's God's work and man's activity, even through fierce opposition. And I think that's got one or two implications for us. It certainly helps us from the tendency to go to two polar tendencies. Now, they're not cold tendencies, they're opposite extremes that we wander towards. The one hand comes from an overemphasis on dependence on God and a playing down of the responsibility of the Christian. It's sort of, relax, yeah, let go. God will do it. If it's God's will, it'll happen. It doesn't matter if I don't, you know, if I don't play my part, if I don't use my gifts, if I don't talk to my friends, if I don't get involved with new non-Christian friends. It doesn't matter if I don't do anything in this mission coming up in 6 weeks. It won't matter. It tends towards a sort of let go, let God philosophy that was around a while back on Christian posters. You know, we just sit back and God will do his stuff. But it's a failure to see that God uses us in his work. Its strength is its dependence on God, but its weakness is its failure to see that God does want to use us, and God does use us in achieving his purposes. If that's one extreme, then the other extreme, on the other hand, is the person who emphasizes the need for hard work. The person who's involved in constant activity, always doing something, but underplays a proper dependence on God. The person who thinks, perhaps not too verbally, but nonetheless thinks that they can manage. The gifted person. The person who thinks that they're able to do all their work for God on their own. That is to miss the point of the text here of Nehemiah. Chapter 2, verse 8, chapter 4, verse 15, chapter 6, verse 15. But God. Now, those verses rescue us from self-confidence or over-self-reliance. The text of Nehemiah keeps the balance, the tension, right. How did the wall get finished? Well, it was God's work, and it was man's work. You see, if we think it's all God's work, we won't do anything. And ultimately, if we think it's all man's work, we won't do anything either. Because when the opposition gets too tough, we'll stop if we think it's all that we're doing. There'll come a point when opposition will be able to stop us. And so if you go to either extreme, you end up doing absolutely nothing. And you'll give up it ultimately being Christian itself. And so back to the question, how was the wall built? The hard effort of man, the sovereign hand of God. And so it's no doubt that it was God who provided this restored city. Last week we closed with the question, why was the wall rebuilt? We've noticed how it was rebuilt, but why was it rebuilt? Why did God make this provision at the end of the Old Testament for his people? Why a restored city? Well, ever since the fall of Jerusalem, the Jews had been looking forward to a rebuilt city. They've been looking forward to a new city. The exile prophets had led them to believe that there was going to be a renewed city with a new king. And so was this it? Was this city rebuilt by Nehemiah, the city that they were waiting for? Was Nehemiah the governor or king who would rule the city? Was this what the prophets looked forward to? No, the text of Nehemiah, and especially the chapters 4 to 6, seem to indicate no, it's not. This is not the fulfillment of all the prophecies of the exile. This is not the new king with a new kingdom. But nonetheless, it is a restored city to act as a foreshadow or a taster or as a symbol to encourage and to give confidence to the people so that they will remain faithful, so that they will keep going, so that they will keep believing until the new king does come and brings the new city. In part, the reason for a restored city seems to be as a foreshadow or a taster of what the new king will bring with a new city in his rule forever. Now, as we read in the New Testament, we know that the provision of this, or the promises of this new city, haven't yet been fulfilled. And they're not going to be fulfilled until heaven, the new Jerusalem, until Jesus the King returns. Now, we don't look to a restored Jerusalem in Israel today to encourage us that God's going to keep his promises and that there is going to be this wonderful new Jerusalem, heaven, where we will dwell with him for eternity. Now, we don't look to a physical city now. Nonetheless, we do have foreshadowing or a symbol that one day we will dwell in this new city, ruled by the King, Jesus, forever. We, like the Jews, at the end of the Old Testament period, have to wait. It's not here yet. It hasn't yet come. But God, nonetheless, has provided. And as he provided for his people at the end of the Old Testament period a restored city, so he's provided, at least in part for us, his church. Weak as it is, imperfect as it is, but nonetheless as a foreshadowing of the new city that's going to be where we will dwell with him in eternity forever. Look forward whilst living faithfully in the present. Here, God gives to his people the restored city of Jerusalem. How does it get built? Well, through fierce opposition. It gets built through the hard work of the people, but ultimately under the sovereign hand of God. So we're led to see a God who provides for his people, that they may remain faithful to him. Let's pause and be quiet for a moment or two together. God's provision here comes through the hard work of men and women, but through his sovereign hand. May mean we need to redress a balance that we've overemphasized, and we need to come back to understanding that tonight, that we'll be committed to working hard for God in the areas he's called us to serve him, but that we'll have a proper dependence upon him. And so however hard it is and however fierce the opposition to it is, let's pray tonight that we may remain faithful to him and be grateful to him that he's provided us with all resources we need in order to do that. Amen.